It's my pleasure to welcome my dear friend Phil Haslinger to and introduce you to him. I've actually known Phil longer than I've known Gilbert, my husband. When I started at the Capital Times in February of 1990, Phil was already there and remained a colleague for many years until he caught us off guard by announcing that he was leaving journalism to join the ministry. And you can imagine how a collection of journalists reacted to that. You're what? So that's what he did. And he served as pastor then for 10 years at Memorial United Church of Christ in Fitchburg. And then recently he has been involved with Christ Presbyterian Church as a volunteer very actively. He has served on the board of Just Dane, an organization that works with formerly incarcerated people. He also is a volunteer with the Prison Ministry Project, helping with their restorative justice program. He also keeps his hand in journalism and religion by serving as chair of the advisory board of the Center for Journalism Ethics and the advisory council of the Religion News Service, which, by the way, is a really excellent place for news and analysis about all things religion. He and his wife Ellen live in Fitchburg, and they have children and grandchildren scattered across the country. So welcome to Phil.
Thanks, Judy. It is great to be here with you all. As I was saying to folks, this is what a beautiful place you have. I've seen it from the outside. I've never been inside. And Judy talks about sort of the move from journalism to ministry. And I like to say, I get to straddle the worlds of skepticism and belief. And I think that's a really good place to be. And so I really enjoy that. Judy mentioned I've been hanging out lately at Christ Presbyterian Church in Madison, which it turns out is 1 year older than the Free Congregation. We go back to 1851, you go back to 1852, so we can both celebrate our longevity. And while we're part of a denomination, one of our core principles at Christ Pres is this: doubt plus faith. We humbly approach the mysteries of faith and complexity of life through continual learning. We encourage questions and curiosity, which I think reflects a lot of what you all try to do here. So while we're anchored in Christianity, we share that inquisitive spirit. And some of our pastors over the years have gotten in trouble for that very spirit, but that's a different story. And my ordination as a minister is in the United Church of Christ. You got one just down the street here. The acronym for that is UCC, which is sometimes referred to as Unitarians Considering Christ. So, you know, I just feel right at home here. Today, I want to reflect with you a bit on how we who are white find ways to cross the divide from people of different races and ethnic groups, and perhaps in that process, help create a more just society for all. I will weave bits of my own story in this, not because I've always done it right or had it figured out, but because I've learned a few lessons along the way, and each of our stories are unique. So you may find something useful in what I say, or you may want to try and adapt some of the principles that I talk about to your own story. Let me start with some of the words that will shape my reflections. And I need to share my screen, it turns out. Host disabled participant screen sharing. Apparently. Well, I'll sing and dance for a few minutes while we wait. And what you will see is a slide that will come. There are a number of words that I'm going to use to sort of organize this, which I think they kind of progress in how we think about these things. Words like proximity, exploration, vulnerability, curiosity, relationships, lamenting, humility, mending, actions, and joy. There, that one, yep. There we go, and we'll make this full screen, and we'll move forward. So there's a list of words. We'll keep coming back to those as we go along. Brian Stevenson, the author of a book, Just Mercy, and he's the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative that has created powerful places in Montgomery, Alabama, that bring visitors up close to the power and the terror of racism. Brian says, to change the world, we're each going to have to find ways to get closer to people who are living on the margins of society. He talks a lot about proximity. He gave a speech a few years ago when he described working with a man on death row, getting close enough to a condemned man to hear his song. Stevenson widened the image this way. When you get proximate, you hear the songs. And those melodies in those songs will empower you, they will inspire you, they will teach you what doing justice and loving mercy is all about. That's why I'm urging you, he writes, all of you, to find ways to get closer to the poor and the excluded, the marginalized, the neglected, and to go with an open heart and listen for the songs that will teach you the things we need to understand. When I was growing up, I did not have any of that proximity. Now I know there are people here who probably had much more proximity than I did to others from varied backgrounds. And I hope when we get to the discussion, you can help widen the conversation. I came from Marinette, a very small white city in northeastern Wisconsin, to Madison, a much larger, majority white, but increasingly diverse city. When I was growing up in Marinette, it was a city of about 14,000 nestled on the shore of the Menominee River that formed the border with Michigan. The diversity there at that time involved religion, Catholic, Protestant, a smattering of Jewish people, and ethnic heritage. German, French, Irish, and Polish were the identifiers of the four Catholic churches in town. If there was anyone in either Marinette or its sister city across the river, Menominee, Michigan, who was not white, I never saw them. Let's detour for a moment to some statistics that might provide some context for where we are now. Marinette now is still 93% white. Sauk County, where we are today, 88% white. Madison, 72% white. Fitchburg, where I live, 63% white. Still not hugely diverse. Take a look at the racial and ethnic diversity. In Sauk County here, 8% of the population is Hispanic, 1% Black, 1% Native American, and 2% a variety of others. And in Dane County, 8% Hispanic, 6% Asian, 5% Black, 7% multicultural. In Fitchburg, where there's a little more diversity, it's 16% Hispanic, 11% Black, 5% Asian. One common thread you might have noticed: the largest non-white population in our area is Hispanic, not Black. And that presents some interesting challenges for us because of language and immigration status. The idea of having a gathering here honoring the people who've been killed by ICE is part of how we pay attention to those sorts of things. So you can see in those numbers the difficulty in finding proximity. It's not just right around the corner, so we have to work at it. For me, that began when I was in high school. For my sophomore, junior, and senior years, I attended Sacred Heart Seminary in Oneida, Wisconsin, a Catholic school for young people like me thinking about becoming a priest. The seminary was located on the land of the Oneida tribe. The building that you see here is now the Oneida Nation School. That was the building I was in. You can see the Oneida symbol on one edge of it there. And when we ventured off campus, we would encounter some tribal members at the convenience store they ran, but the students and the faculty were all white. During the summer of 1966, between my junior and senior high school years, I volunteered to work with what was called the Migrant Ministry in Oconto, which is near Marinette, where migrant workers, mostly from the Brownsville area of Texas, came every summer to pick cucumbers for the Bond Pickle Company. My job was to work with the kids during their daytime schooling and recreation. My proximity was growing just a little bit, and so were the challenges, since I don't speak Spanish. During the four summers I worked with migrants, I moved from the guy who took the kids out to play to someone who helped communicate the issues around migrant labor and housing and education and such
to the wider Oconto community through newspaper columns and a radio broadcast. I began to understand the societal issues around migrant labor. Meanwhile, at the seminary, there was a growing awareness of the movement for civil rights occurring around the nation. This was in the mid-1960s. Because the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had built alliances across religious traditions, we were aware of his role in that. We were also aware of the role of Father James Grappi, white Catholic priest in Milwaukee, who lived in slum housing and who served as an advisor to the NAACP Youth Council. He helped lead a series of open housing marches in Milwaukee. In October 1966, he came to the seminary with seven members of the Youth Council so they could talk to us about civil rights, education, the role of the church. Grappi said Christ was a civil rights worker. Listening to the Youth Council members talk was probably the first time I had any kind of meaningful engagement with people who were Black. So that was the beginnings of my journey into a more diverse world. The second word on my list is exploration. I actually began seeking out ways to find proximity. My desire to learn more about the work of King, the urgency of finding a path to racial justice, my understanding of what followers of Jesus were being called to, these all intensified. I heard about a program at a place called Friendship House in Chicago and signed up for their week-long interracial immersion. At the heart of the program, white attendees lived with Black families in Chicago, giving us a chance to have a glimpse of the Black experience. I was sleeping in the basement in the home of this middle-aged Black couple, eating grits for breakfast, and then walking through a virtually all-Black neighborhood to catch the bus that would take me to Friendship House on the South Side. I was very aware of how different I was from everyone else. I'd never been a minority before. The family I lived with was friendly, but not too talkative. On Wednesday, the family I was staying with took me next door to meet their neighbors. We sat around the living room having a beer. They asked me what I'd been doing. I told them about the various speakers we heard over the past few days, a Black Chicago police sergeant who talked about racism he saw and experienced on the force, Saul Alinsky, the community organizer who was a huge figure in Chicago, a priest who worked in the Black neighborhoods and was trying to do things with them. The woman we were visiting began to tell me about being Black in a white society. The intensity of her feelings was overwhelming, softened only by occasional assurances that I shouldn't take this personally. It sure felt personal. I don't remember any of the words she said, only the heat of her anger. It was my first experience facing Black rage in a very personal way. It shook me for sure. But it also opened my eyes to one slice of the reality of being Black in America. So that gets me to our third word, vulnerability. One of the big challenges of getting outside of the places where we feel comfortable is a willingness to be vulnerable. By the time I turned 20, despite coming from such a white city and attending such a white seminary, I'd been in some contact with African Americans, Latinos, Oneida tribal members. And more than contact, actually, I had felt welcomed across the lines that seemed to divide so much of our country. That at least gave me some confidence to begin engaging people from a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds. Next up, UW-Madison. Wisconsin's major university was not all that much more diverse than the rest of the state, still isn't, but it was swept up in the social justice movements of the late 1960s. The winter before I came to campus in August of 1969 as a junior, Black students at UW led a strike that pushed the administration to create the Department of African American Studies. One of the first demonstrations I encountered in Madison was a welfare rights march from Milwaukee to Madison led by Father Grappi. The marchers took over the state assembly chambers during the first day, and then demonstrators, including me, ringed the Capitol for the next several days. One evening, I wound up being with Sylvester, a 46-year-old Black man who was part of the leadership. He was collecting bail money from the crowd. We came across another man that Sylvester was pretty sure was collecting the money for his own purposes. So he tried to persuade him to bring the money to the office. The man responded by pulling a .38 pistol out of his lightweight yellow jacket. "You accusing me of being a thief?" he said to Sylvester. "Get out of here before I shoot you." My inclination was to get out of there, but Sylvester had other ideas. "Go ahead and shoot," he replied. He said, as I'm sure my eyes were getting as wide as saucers, "I know I'm right, and you know I'm right, and I don't mind dying." After a few tense moments of silence, the man put his gun back in his pocket, and they both walked into the office to deposit the bail money. I started to breathe again. Talk about feeling vulnerable. It was a powerful moment on several levels, including the power of an active, nonviolent response to a threat. And for me, it was also a lesson that this black man from Milwaukee would be my protector. And then it was on to the Capital Times. First as a reporter covering politics in the state and the city, and then in 1975, starting to cover education in the city. And that's when I was again encountering the issues of race. Curiosity is not a bad word for a journalist. If we're not curious about things, we're not going to do very well. And I think it's a good trait for all of us. Can we bring a sense of wonder to the opportunities we have to spend time with when we're with somebody who's not like us? One of the things I was curious about that was starting to be paid was one of the things I was curious about was the attention that was starting to be paid to increasing numbers of students of color in the Madison schools. In 1976, I wrote a four-part series on racial issues in the Madison public schools. The first story was headlined, "Minorities Isolated Within Schools." At that point, 1976, 95% of the students in the Madison schools were white. Today, 39% are white, 25% are Hispanic, 18% are black, 10% are two or more races, 8% are Asian. But back in the 70s, it was very white. Some of the quotes about that series from the Madison schools have an awfully familiar ring 40 years later. Richard Buchanan, the school district human relations director, said he saw minority students in Madison miseducated in a system with the best educational opportunities in the country. And Madison continues to struggle with these issues as the schools and the city become more diverse. So I was curious about what could I do that might make some kind of a difference. In 1987, I learned about a project led by Marlene Cummings, a curriculum specialist for the Madison School's Human Relations Department, who went from classroom to classroom in Madison elementary schools to help children learn how to respect one another's differences. She created a project known as Celebrate Difference. I wrote an editorial for the Cap Times in February of 1988, inviting our readers to join the Celebrate Difference project that had been extended by UW-Madison Dean of Students Mary Rouse and campus religious leaders to create a more positive atmosphere in the midst of some of the racial tensions on campus. Nearly 3,000 people on campus signed the pledge to celebrate differences and confront racism and prejudice. And over the next several months, another 750 people responded to the invitation we had in the Cap Times. The project also sparked an internal examination of the newspaper about the lack of diversity on our staff and the way we cover stories in the community. We hired trainers to come in and work with our staff and then invited community members to come to staff meetings to share their perceptions with us. Those perceptions were not particularly flattering towards our work. As this wrapped up in late 1988, I wrote a column about how I had tried to use the Celebrate Difference Project to expand my own cultural horizons. Indeed, over the course of that year, I had formed relationships with a wide variety of community leaders, some of which continue to this day. In that column, I referred to my background growing up all white and concluded, "Celebrate Difference means I can celebrate my own heritage, my German ancestry, my white skin, my Catholic beliefs, my masculinity, my marriage, without diminishing the heritage of others. It means I can reach out beyond that personal heritage and celebrate with others at a Black Gospel Festival or a Hispanic Fiesta. It means I can learn from the status stories of a Menominee Indian or a Hmong refugee." In the city of Madison, meanwhile, more and more African Americans were finding this a city of refuge from the streets of Chicago and Milwaukee and other troubled communities. Most of them simply sought a better life for themselves and their children. Others came to continue the exploitation of those seeking a better life. Madison began to react more and more strongly and negatively to its growing diversity. I was writing quite a bit about issues of race during that stretch, both in editorials and columns, There were headlines on my columns like racial politics make divisive problems worse and race poverty creates stark images. I tried in many ways to focus my writing on these issues as Madison was struggling with the challenge of how to become a more multiracial city. And one aspect of such a challenge is how folks in the media deal with issues of race. In the late 1990s into the 2000s, I was part of a group that convened periodic race and media forums, bringing together news people from a variety of outlets with representatives of the Black community. These were often uncomfortable, as we heard the many ways we were failing an important segment of our community, a lack of diversity on our staffs, an overemphasis on negative stories involving people of color, a lack of positive news, disconnection from the daily lives of Black residents, a historic distrust of white media by Black folks. Once again, we opened up some challenges to communication, but the problems linger. It offered an opportunity not only to assess, but to lament, another one of those key words. And that word is not often used in common conversation. My friend Christine Jeske, in her new book, Racial Justice for the Long Haul, describes it this way. Lament names the bad, it acknowledges specific hurts and harms. Participating in lament is an act of resistance against the dominant ways of responding to harm, both for sufferers and for those who cause the suffering. Lament does not necessarily fix what's wrong, but it brings people together to acknowledge the ways people are affected by harm. Lament is a posture that acknowledges the boulder of racism is heavy, and pushing against it will be a struggle. I wrote my own reflections in 2005 on race and media, focusing specifically on the Cap Times, where I was now the managing editor, the second highest spot in the newsroom. I knew that for over 40 years, the Cap Times had hired perhaps 8 Black journalists. We'd worked with the Simpson Street Free Press to nurture young writers. We'd provided internship opportunities for high school students. We had partners with our neighbors at Wright Middle School and the Evie Foundation, which donates the paper's profits to the community, funded an annual minority journalism scholarship at UW-Madison. I'd brought my friend Dory Maynard to do another newsroom training on race. But still, in 2005, as I looked through 3 months' worth of papers, trying to see them as if I were a person of color, I wrote, I did not find much I could identify with. The overall impression I got was that this was a publication written by and for white folks. Despite many attempts, there were still huge gaps in our efforts to reach beyond our traditional white readership. There are also moments when I realized huge gaps in my understanding of what it meant to be Black in America. When the nation was waiting for the verdict in the O.J. Simpson double murder trial in October of 1995, the famous Black athlete accused of stabbing 2 white people to death, we had the TV on in the Cap Times newsroom. We did it along with many. And then the verdict, not guilty. Linda Lockhart, one of our copy editors who was Black, stood up and cheered yes and pumped her fist in the air. I was totally perplexed. It was so clear to me and all the other white folks in the newsroom that Simpson should have been found guilty. How could Linda, an incredibly smart and perceptive journalist, see it otherwise? She had given no clue during the trial what she hoped the outcome would be. I learned over time the depth of feeling among Black folks about the injustices of our so-called justice system, particularly towards Black men accused of killing white women. Whatever the reality, here was a high-profile case in which the verdict favored the Black man, and Linda and some of the other Black folks were relieved and thrilled. And then I was in the midst of changing careers, as Judy mentioned, from journalism to ministry. One of the opportunities that created for me was to engage around issues of race and religion, and in the process, establish new relationships with people connected with the growing Black church world in Madison. That's another really important word, relationships. While I developed some during my time in journalism, these relationships grew deeper and opened up new ways I could connect with people, not just as public figures, but as colleagues and as friends. A place where I began to experience that was part of the Martin Luther King Community Choir, directed by Leotha and Tamara Stanley of Mount Zion Baptist Church. The choir sings each year at the Madison-Dane County King Celebration in January and sometimes other places. And as part of that weekend, it also sings at an ecumenical church service honoring King's life. That event tends to get a smaller number of choir members. So one year there were only two of us bassists and we had a very exposed line, which we blew. The crowd cheered us on and encouraged us. And I got a wonderful sense of how a black church, in a way that is both joyful and caring, can carry those of us who stumble, even if in a line of music. I served as pastor at Memorial UCC in Fitchburg, and while I was there, I formed a partnership with Pastor Collier McNair of Mount Zion City Church, seeking ways to connect our two congregations, which in many ways were mirror images, one mostly black and Pentecostal, one mostly white and mainstream Protestant. My relationship with Coley and his then wife Myra and members of the congregation grew stronger, but the connections between the two congregations did not bond the way we had hoped, but it was still a worthwhile effort. And I had a vivid reminder at Memorial that I really do not have all this racial stuff figured out. I remember the day a black man drove up to the church. I saw him walking from his car toward the church, and I figured, just another person seeking some sort of financial assistance. Turns out, he was a business guy who needed directions to his next appointment. That was my personal preconception. Call it implicit bias coming through. And that brings me to yet another word on the list, humility. I learned that if you're going to form relationships across cultures, you cannot be too rigid about expecting folks not like you to share your beliefs or your style of worship or your politics. So you have to ask yourself, what's the priority here? Purity of belief or plentitude of connection? And how do you sort those out so you can stay true to your beliefs and widen the circles of relationships, being open to how that might affect those you're with and how they might affect your beliefs? Here's an instance of when my own privileged status allowed me and most of the folks I hang out with to totally miss one of the great racial divides in Madison. Colleen Kerr was then director of the Greater Madison Area Urban League. And in 2010, he proposed a public school that would serve black boys and black girls called Madison Prep. There was heated debate involving the school board, the teachers union, members of the black community, members of the white community, culminating in an emotion-laden six-hour school board meeting in December of 2011, when many black folks explained in painful detail the way the Madison schools had failed them and their children. After it was over, I got this Facebook message from my friend Lucy Mathiak, a friend who was on the school board. Hi, Phil. I'm curious about the relative silence of the clergy, other than some African-American clergy, on the debate over Madison Prep, race, and public education. Here was part of my reply. At least in the circles of clergy I run with, it never even came up as a point of discussion. I suspect that's in part because our congregations tend to be predominantly white, and there's less of a personal sense of urgency about the outcomes for African-American students in the schools. While there's a generalized sense of the need for something to be done, people don't feel the same stake in it that African-Americans' families do. At the congregation I serve in Fitchburg, I've never heard any talk about Madison Prep at all. This is what happens when we live in our own racial and ethnic bubbles. The idea of Madison Prep eventually evolved into one city school, a charter school that started a decade ago under the auspices of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's hardly solved all the educational gaps in Madison schools, but it's one step toward mending the disparities in our community. And mending, that's the next word. That brings me to the real hard part of this. What the heck do we who are white do now in a society sharply divided by race and ethnicity and inequities? What do we do in the face of a political storm that is deepening, not mending, those divisions? Christine Jeske, who I mentioned earlier, writes that social injustice is like a tear in the fabric that's meant to hold society together. And Brian Stevenson says, proximity is a good place to start, but other steps must follow. Some of it involves learning from and building on those relationships that we form and being open to the differences that are part of that. Christine tells the story of her friend Shauna, who who lives in an increasingly diverse community in the Western U.S., where a sizable East African population has moved in as the community recruited workers for the town's meatpacking plant. One of her students from East Africa bought food for Shanna's family while Shanna was out of town. The woman is the mother of 5 small children. Her husband's a truck driver. She has plenty of mouths to feed in her own family. Shanna, who's black, told Christine, who is white, "My friend could have given my family something she thought we would want, like macaroni and cheese or pizza, but she didn't know how to make those things. She could have just made something the way she makes it for her family. Instead, she chose to make food she knew each person in my household enjoyed. She knew our daughter liked Dorawat, and my husband enjoyed her lentil sambusa. She even lowered the spice level. She stayed rooted in her cultural identity while adapting her gift to offer it in a way that could be received." People reaching across cultures, adapting in small ways to make a bigger difference and sharing the story. The fabric was made a little stronger. But while the mending is personal, it also goes beyond that to build on what we learn in those relationships to build a more just society. One of the ways of thinking about justice is it means bringing about a right relationship between peoples. And that takes action. Brian Stevenson says that one step in challenging and changing narratives that feed bigotry and hatred and violence, we have to work on that. Those narratives lead people to tolerate things they never should tolerate. And that sometimes requires us to do uncomfortable things. Maybe that means finding ways to let family and friends know that what they just said around the table or on social media is outside the bounds of what we can accept. Judy tells me that over time you as a congregation have tried to make some of those connections that can lead to action. A meal put on by various ethnic groups, helping at a food pantry a couple of times a year where people coming in are often Spanish-speaking, bringing in speakers who can deepen your understanding of the native tribes that were here before us. Sometimes the actions are simply going places where you might encounter people different than you and see if relationships can grow out of that. Here are a couple of ideas from Madison. You might know of others around this area. Madison's only a half hour away. You know, you can buzz in. Next Saturday, the Madison Urban League will host its 12th annual Unity Picnic from noon to 4 at the Black Business Hub on South Park Street, just off the Beltline. Food, crafts, people, music, mingling, chances to talk. Every Thursday afternoon from 4 to 6 until October, Centro Hispano in Madison puts on the Mercadito, a market with food, crafts, games, and music. It's a great place to absorb a little bit of the culture of the home countries of so many Spanish-speaking people who now live in the Madison area. Centro serves people from 40 different countries. If you want to learn about issues around race, explore the Black History for a New Day course put on by the Nehemiah Project in Madison. It's offered both in person and online, and then watch for events at the new Center for Black Excellence and Culture in Madison. So the Black Business Hub, the Center for Black Excellence and Culture, Center, they're all within a couple of blocks each other, just as you come off the Beltline on Park Street. And there are resources you can tap into to help to get to know people across cultures and find events that are coming up. There's Emoja Magazine, there's Capital City Hughes, Madison 365, and more. You all know, I'm sure, of ways you can get involved politically, opposing the kind of cruelty being inflicted on immigrants, moves to roll back voting rights gains that have given Black people a greater voice over the past half century. So, you know, write, protest, do those kinds of things. There's no shortage of places that would love to have your financial support, places that are working to mend that fraying fabric and create a more just world. Happy to offer suggestions, depending on the kinds of causes you're interested in. But all of that takes me to our last word, which is joy, because this can all seem really overwhelming. The things we see happening around us are depressing. If we feel we're trying to do something, pushing that rock up the mountain, we too often feel like we're watching it roll back down. We need to keep our heads above water, to mix a metaphor. Being here with friends is one way of doing that. Doing simple projects together, sharing a community garden, gathering over stitching, doing a woodworking project together, bicycling with others. And there's a big source of joy for me, and that's music. You know how music helped power the civil rights movement. You saw music sustain people in Chicago and Minneapolis as they tried to protect immigrants from ICE. I mentioned earlier what a joy it's been for me to sing in the Martin Luther King Community Choir. If you want a great example of a group that makes all this come alive, look up the Resistance Revival Chorus, and there are many more out there. And you've heard a lot about my life woven through these reflections, but I'm anxious to hear from you as well. What's worked? What have you struggled with? What ideas do you have to get proximity? What ideas do you have to mend the fabric? But first, I'd like to pick up on that last comment about music. I don't know if you like to sing as much as I do, but I hope at least a few would be willing to join me in one of the joyful songs that's pretty familiar, and I think what we're called to do. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Everywhere I go, I'm going to let it shine. Everywhere I go, I'm going to let it shine. Everywhere I go, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. All around the world, I'm going to let it shine. All around the world, I'm going to let it shine. All around the world, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
We could take this on the road, you know. Thank you so much. You heard from me. I'm anxious to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, reflections of your own that we can all share together.
Good comments. And I think, you know, the way we will change what the government is doing is by electing different people. I mean, that's and having the courts intervene, but essentially, ultimately, it becomes up to us to do something. The importance of you were talking about the teachers you were growing up with and the leaders in the military, as we're growing up, to have kids learn that we're not all the same, that sometimes there are struggles that come with that, sometimes you really make good friendships, sometimes you find out you're isolated. Having, as a kid, having grown-ups to help you navigate that rather than pull you farther apart is a really important piece of the puzzle. The notion of the institutions that we're not happy with right now, we need to keep doing that mending with people we know who may not agree with us. How can we find a place where they can understand us a little better, we can understand them a little better, and maybe we can find places where we can move forward. And actually, I brought along people. The first four people who grabbed these, there's the current issue of Capital City Hughes, current issue of Umoja that talked about the Center for Black Excellence and Culture, and some statistics from Central. So I'll put these in back, and you guys can all fight over them. Okay. It's the Black History for a New Day course put on by the Nehemiah Project, which is one of the offshoots of Pastor Alex G's projects, many projects. There is clearly a generational thing that's going on in part, and I think it may depend in part on where you live, but some of the bigger events in Madison, there are a fair number of young people who are out and about and part of that. One of the regular demonstrations in Madison is the Silver Sneakers. There's a reason they're called the Silver Sneakers. They're all old. And they get, line up along a roadway. That's great. Some of us who've been around doing this stuff for a while, but I also run into a lot of younger people who are, they may not be engaged at the protest. They have other ways in which they're engaged. They're working with stuff on social media. They're working in political campaigns. They're doing all sorts of things. It's not the same as it was, maybe when we were all growing up, but I don't there's clearly shifting political viewpoints among young people these days. And there was a much greater youth support for Trump in the 2024 election, and that's shifting away again because people respond to what they need. One of the things I hear from some of the black folks I know is we whites are like in shock because look what Trump is doing. And you know, we've been through this before, right? There was Reconstruction. There was the KKK in the 1920s. This is not new, and we'll keep moving. We're not going to stop. We're going to keep moving forward.
I think we all need to give Phil a round of applause for this presentation.
And thanks to all of you, because you're all doing, all of you in your own ways are doing really good work. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, it was fun to do.